Just 2 days after the IPCC called climate change a code red for humanity, Europe has recorded, as if confirmed, its highest ever temperature.
Emissions of greenhouse gases need to peak within the next 3 years if we're to stave off the worst effects of climate change.
It is a file of shame, cataloguing the empty pledges that put us firmly on track towards an unlivable world.
Well, in cities around the world, activists are rallying for action on climate change. Tens of thousands filled the streets of cities like Melbourne, Rio de Janeiro, Berlin and Paris.
This is an emergency. People are already suffering and dying from the consequences of the climate and environmental emergency.
Climate is the great unifier for a lot of social justice movements. Climate justice is also racial justice. It is also gender justice. It's immigrant rights. It's all of these things intersect around the moves that we make next around climate.
Welcome back, listeners. This is your host, Sadia Khan, in the studio. Climate change is a man-made problem with a feminist solution. This is the tagline of the podcast, Mothers of Invention.
Meet the women who are changing the way we do things.
Litigation creates a narrative that's powerful around climate change.
We went to New York City, shut down 5 different banks in one day.
I am the woman who banned single-use plastic bags in Kenya.
In unexpected, totally genius ways.
Climate solutions calls for a change of consciousness. The work is being done by women of color because our lives depend on it.
I find it unbelievable that you find people like me.
I just want to make sure that I'm on the right side of the revolution when it comes.
Today we are tackling the big elephant in the room, climate change, and thinking through how specific communities like BIPOC women are both at the front lines of climate solutions, and yet these marginalized groups are also the very ones historically oppressed and more at risk of climate-related impacts. The fight for climate justice is more than multi-pronged. It requires an inward and outward cultural shift. I'm talking about regenerative compassion for others and immense self-care in the face of this intimidating issue. And Thimali Kodikara is going to help us. Thimali is the series producer of Mothers of Invention, which is hosted by former Irish president Mary Robinson and comedian writer Maeve Higgins. Their platform uncovers stories of climate justice heroes, giving focus to Black, Brown, and Indigenous women who are holding up the microphone to climate action in the boardroom, at marches, with their peers, and beyond. Beyond her work in the podcast world and more currently, Thimali advises on climate strategies and also is a recognized public figure for climate advocacy. She has consulted global and regional organizations like Human Rights Watch and BAFTA on how to adopt intersectional feminist principles in their climate policies. She's full of sage but incredibly personable and funny too. One thing I took away from this conversation is that fighting climate change is a marathon and it can be rife with anxiety. However heavy the matter is, though, we deserve moments of brevity and silliness. Thank you, Thimali, for showing me and our listeners that. So let's get started. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Sadia.
For our listeners, you are in a lot of pain and I feel terrible that I dragged you here, but I had to.
I'm fully willing to be dragged for this podcast appearance on Immigrantly. I'm so happy to be here with you.
So today we are going to talk about climate disaster, catastrophe that's happening right now. And you and I are going to solve this issue in an hour.
Yeah, absolutely.
How does that
easily
sound?
Done. It's so easily done.
Right?
1 hour is all it. Yeah, absolutely.
But here's the thing. Your accent, your British accent, will soften the blow for white folks. What do you think?
It's my secret superpower. It's like I'm waving my British accent in front of people's faces, so they think that nice things are happening, but actually I'm like going in for the kill. So, but it's working so far.
I wish my accent was as revered and as coveted as this one, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a story about that, actually, is that at the age of 4 years old, I think I was four, my parents marched me, my sister, and my brother off to elocution lessons. So at 4 years old, and I was in elocution lessons at Miss Wise's house every Friday night after school from the age of four until I was 18. No joke. And so I was learning to pronounce my words clearly and properly with the utmost attention to my vocabulary, and I would talk like this. And I hated all of the friends that I was making because I was sounding so annoying and posh. But eventually, you know, I made it to the East End whilst I was at art school in London, and then it was like, all right, girls, let's go down the pub and have a couple. And I said, all of a sudden, I did have friends that I really enjoyed the company of. So, but it worked, you know. I hate to say it. My parents did it on purpose. They were both immigrants to the UK in the 1960s, late 1960s. And I think they knew that this would be a superpower, this accent, you know. And both my siblings have got great jobs and great access to opportunity. I literally, you know, co-host a podcast now too, so it worked out for me as well. But part of the work I'm trying to do is creating access for people that don't have lovely Southwest London accents.
Talking about your work, Thimali, now before we delve into it, I just want to set the stage and understand where in the climate change equation you are inhabiting space. What does that work entail?
So I am the series producer and co-host now of a podcast on feminist solutions to the climate crisis. And I actually co-host the show with a comedian, a brilliant, hilarious comedian called Maeve Higgins, who is an avid podcaster also, as well as the former president of Ireland, Mary Robinson. So my sweary London rants, I have to sort of put them aside to hang out with Mary. But they're both absolutely amazing, brilliant women who have taught me so much. I joined the show as the producer in season two, and I actually was given the show by the creators when there were really enormous climate issues that were sort of kicking off in 2019. But I truthfully didn't really know anything about climate. I mean, I knew about the climate Paris Accord and, you know, all sort of the big ticket key issues. But honestly, I just thought that climate was a white folks issue. That is how it was being presented in the media, something that will happen in the future. But actually, I'd a couple of years earlier bumped into a friend who was also Sri Lankan like me, and she was in the immigration movement in New York City, which is where I live too. And she quit her job to work in climate. And we were all like, what are you doing? Climate is a white people's issue. This is crazy. What are you talking about? And she was like, no, 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 I swear these things are all connected. Yeah. And I was like, okay, whatever, put it aside. But always really respected her work. And that was what I was thinking about when I was invited to take on the show, and kept aware of where those clues would be in the work. And then actually it was pretty early on, Mary Robinson and I were having a chat after the first episode record, I think. And I said to her, you know, I feel like people are using the terms environmental justice and climate justice interchangeably. Do you do that?
Yeah.
And she said, well, no, because climate specifically refers to the existential crisis on planet Earth. And that sort of connected a lot. I mean, it was like an instant switch went off in my brain. And when I thought about all the systemic issues that were happening in the environmental justice world, it was 10, 20, 100-fold in the climate world, and it was Global South folks. And then I started thinking about, wow, like, my aunt was killed in the tsunami in 2003. And, you know, I still have lots of relatives in Sri Lanka who, you know, send photos of themselves wading through floods. And then I was like, oh, right. And then, you know, this friend who comes from this country and this friend whose parents still live there. And it was all of a sudden I was like, oh, my God, climate is a Black and brown and Indigenous people's issue. First and foremost, how is it not being told? How is this story not being told in this way? And then I immediately sort of felt like I knew what I wanted and needed to do. And I'm very lucky that Mary and Maeve and our executive producer is very supportive of my thinking, my ideas. And effectively, audiences are listening to me learning about climate on the fly, you know, sort of unfolding. You know, they're sort of watching it unfold in my mind. But, you know, what is amazing about the show also is that it's not just a straight information share. Like, it's right. It's a social justice impact media project, quite a mouthful, but it means that we're not just handing over a bunch of info to people. We're actually trying to find ways for the audience to sort of get their butts off seats and go do something. And on the back end, we're finding ways for our guests on the show who are actively trying to do this work to support them too. And they are mostly Black and brown and Indigenous women, girls, gender non-conforming folks, and their allies. We've had like 5 men on the show. That's but you have to be a really high caliber if you're going to be on the show.
Thamali, there's so much to unpack in what you just said. First, feminist solutions to climate change. What does that mean? So that's the first thing that I want you to expand on. And then we'll also get to why Black, brown, Indigenous folks normally think that climate change is white persons' issues, while climate change is disproportionately impacting Black, brown, and Indigenous communities. So where is the disconnect? Why this dichotomy? What are we missing? So let's start with the feminist part, which I'm really interested in.
Yeah, I feel like you probably already know the answer to this question too. If you look at a massive crisis like COVID, it really was women's leadership in particular that really, you know, took hold of the reins and got a lot of stuff done from go. And a lot of the reason that tends to be is because women and femmes will tend to look at society or their community holistically.
Right.
They're looking at every single person within the network, not just one powerful aspect of it, right? They're definitely not trying to, you know, dominate over the community either. Mm. I always say, of all the awful things that have happened on planet Earth in the last, like, 5-10 years, like, give me a list of 10 women that caused any of these problems for us, you know? Turn on the telly any point in the history and it's just a lot of dudes breaking things. So women do have a tendency, and femmes, as I said, have a tendency to look at everybody in the picture. So the flip side of that is that in a climate context, Black and brown and Indigenous women, girls, do tend to be the most deeply affected. To give an example, we've had a guest on the show called Hindu Umaru Ibrahim, who is a wonderful woman, a nomadic Indigenous woman from Chad. And she tells us stories about how, you know, in her community next to Lake Chad, who've been very dependent on Lake Chad, an enormous lake, but actually 90% of it has dried up due to climate change. 90%. That's due to high temperatures. So aside from dealing with these extremely high temperatures, they're dealing with, you know, lack of access to food now, as they can't grow anything in that kind of heat. You know, new diseases. Mm. They're having to look after usually quite large families who are there to sort of help with farming or for maintaining the household. Because, you know, agriculture is a part of their lifestyle, men, you know, the husbands are not able to grow anything in those regions anymore, so they have to leave. And they too have to, you know, they're at a loss for their own culture, right? They're having to go to cities do very sort of culturally disorientating new, you know, jobs to bring money back home. But in that time, it's still the women who are left behind in those communities trying to problem solve and adapt to these kinds of new extremes. And, you know, then you've got other, you know, more simple, less obvious things like women who are in saris or big traditional clothing that can't run during times of disaster. Like things like that we don't really think about because we don't have that cultural context always, but are really hugely important all the same.
But do you think solutions that people present, whether at conferences or in other settings, are more whitewashed or catered to a specific population? Because the kind of things that you're talking about, a lot of people wouldn't even know, especially decision makers. So how do we bridge that gap?
Also a great question. I mean, we're kind of stuck in this mess because our political leaders, our business leaders, media, are not having this conversation, or not having the conversation deeply enough, or not having the conversation fast enough. There are, in the meanwhile, people who are really doing that work. And again, that's sort of who we're trying to feature on the show. People who are thinking about the problem holistically and not in this sort of piecemeal way. I did actually attend COP26, which is this huge global, you know, UN conference that happens every year, which was not on during the pandemic, but COP26, which happened in Glasgow in November, was the first time in a while that people have been able to congregate around this. And, you know, it is a very dry and frustrating experience in many ways. There is what's happening inside of the negotiations, and I have lots of colleagues and community who were in the rooms and would leave, like, you know, completely infuriated. But then simultaneously, what was beautiful, which I didn't actually know existed until I got there, was the People's Summit, which was a week long of events, talks, conversations that was happening, that was hosted by various BIPOC Indigenous folks from all over the world who sat in church halls and little art galleries and all over Glasgow, far from the negotiations were happening, to problem solve these issues. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is where all of the real work is happening right now.
When we think of COP26, it's been 26 years.
Longer.
Longer, right? We haven't really achieved much. Am I being too skeptical here? Am I missing something?
I mean, you're not wrong, right? Hmm. We've got 9 years to go. We're way off, you know, enormous targets in terms of carbon, in terms of money, you know, being directed to the right people in the right places, like way, way, way off. I've been doing this work now for about 4 years, and I still actually can't believe how little most people know about it. And I think a lot of that is around the fear and anxiety. Like, they know, I think most people know it's bad. That sort of brings on this petrifying fear. Or there's the other end of the spectrum, which is like, well, there's nothing we can do about it anyway, which obviously comes from an incredibly privileged position.
Or feeling of helplessness too, right?
Right.
Sometimes that can happen.
Right.
But when do you think, and not when, how do you think we can move from that place of helplessness or focusing too much on personal virtue of, say, recycling, which in some instances wouldn't work? Like, plastic recycling doesn't work. Metal paper, yes, but plastic doesn't, right? To collective accountability, which also includes accountability of corporations and making them less harmful, probably, because obviously we can't escape the system completely, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's an awful statistic for you, which is that only 9% of recycling actually is recycled in the world. A lot of that is actually just shipped off to where? Obviously, black and brown countries, and it's burnt there. So the emissions are there, basically.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, recycling is really rubbish, pun intended. I think collective action is absolutely where it's at. Like, we can't keep putting blame on individuals for, you know, not getting things right.
It's making them feel like shit. Exactly. If I don't recycle things, I feel so bad. And I'm not saying that I shouldn't play a role in this, but there are bigger problems that we need to address, which we are not addressing.
Absolutely. And they are all huge systemic issues. Mm. And I too felt that moment of helplessness too. Just like, it's enormous. It's absolutely enormous. But two things I would say. There is the moment that everything really clicked into place for me, I realized, oh my God, like climate is the great unifier for a lot of social justice movements, actually. Like, climate justice is also racial justice. It is also gender justice. It's immigrant rights. It's all of these things intersect around the moves that we make next around climate. You know, if we are considering the whole of society, then, you know, this climate justice is a way to really create new opportunities, create opportunities for women, for immigrants, for people of color. But say immigration, for example, right? Climate is going to create around, there are estimations, between 800 million to 1.3 billion migrants across the world before the end of the century. That is an enormous, enormous number. We think of immigration as just being like folks trekking it over borders. Again, it's a systemic issue. If we can deal with our climate issues, we can allow people to stay at home, in which is where they want to be, right? They want to be in their home countries. So it's an opportunity to kill many birds with one stone. But then, you know, in terms of the feeling of helplessness that you mentioned, to me, from everything that I have seen and the incredibly diverse community of people that I've spoken to over the years, the answer is organizing with your communities. And I sort of have always sort of contracted thinking about this because I am not necessarily a part of any community organizing. Like, I am quite actively a part of immigrant rights movements and racial justice movements and things like that within Brooklyn, which is where I live. But actually getting together with your friends and realizing that you actually do have power. There have been some amazing moves made all over the world, people taking their governments to court, stopping pipelines. Like, that is not being led by business leaders or politicians or even the media. It's regular people like you and me who get together with a bunch of pals and say, we don't want this for ourselves. And we're going to try because what other option is there? Complacency is not going to get us anywhere. And, you know, to use an example like Greta Thunberg, who joined the climate movement or created this modern climate movement with various other young people around the world, she talks a lot about how depressed she was. And there is a lot, climate anxiety is a real thing. She wasn't eating, you know, she was having real difficulty making friends and things like that. But slowly through building community, all over the world, she, you know, has a boyfriend, I've heard, and, you know, is able to eat diverse foods again and all that sort of thing. So I'm, absolutely, I can see it. I see the power of getting together with your friends and getting involved. So that is something that I am sort of making my way to really commit to myself.
If you're here, I know you're really interested in change. So I am excited to tell you about Undistracted, a weekly podcast from my friends at Meteor, hosted by activist and educator Brittany Packnett Cunningham. Every week, Brittany takes a very personal look at the news from an intersectional feminist viewpoint, which you know I like. Brittany talks to each week's newsmakers about the change they strive for every day. So you'll hear from folks like Anita Hill, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Congresswoman Cori Bush, Tracy Ellis Ross, Tarana Burke, and more. Plus, she'll catch you up on the latest untrending news. Stuff you might have missed that you definitely need to know. Undistracted comes out weekly on Thursdays. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pandora, Pocket Casts, Stitcher, or Odyssey. And you can find The Meteor at The Meteor on Instagram. Our next partner has a product I use literally every day. I started taking AG1 by Athletic Greens because I wanted better gut health and wanted a supplement that actually tastes great, and also wanted to see what the hype was all about. Now I have been on it for a few weeks and I love it. Fun fact, it doesn't taste like it's super healthy. It has a kind of mild tropical taste and I actually look forward to it each morning. With just one delicious scoop of AG1, you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop in a cup of water every day. That's how I take it. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/emerging. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/emerging to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. What are the most pressing institutions or industries that need further accountability, right? So who are we not calling out enough? And what solutions do you have in mind for that?
I mean, quite obviously the fossil fuel industry, that's a no-brainer. But, you know, the people who can have the most impact over fossil fuel industries are our elected leaders. So if we're not, you know, doing our research, if we're not showing up and even voting, let alone voting for the right folks, what options do we have? That's an incredibly powerful tool, you know. I'm going to add to that, though, running for office. Why not? Why not run for office in your community? That is also an incredible way to hold people accountable.
But where do you start when you think of running for office? Even I've thought about this a few times, but then I'm like, nobody knows me. I am Muslim woman, immigrant. Who would vote for me?
You know, that's a lot of folks in the right. House and Senate right now, right? AOC was a bartender, you know? It's regular people who can speak on behalf of their communities that we really need, right? That's what we really need. People who, again, women and femmes who are able to see the whole picture, who are willing and excited to provide for everybody in the room, not just a few. So why not? Why not you? Why not me? You know? Oh, God, why not me?
Yeah, why not you,
Dimari? Put myself on the line.
When we think of climate crisis and what's happening, especially when we think of fossil fuel industry, most of these organizations have known for a long time the disastrous impact of climate change, right? They've known it for maybe 20, 30, even 40 years. And nothing much has happened since then because all of these corporations are for profit. So they are more concerned about the bottom line, how much profit they make, and how they can maximize profit, which makes sense in terms of who they are, right? They are for-profit organizations.
Right.
We can't expect them not to focus on that. How do we build coalitions in a way which sounds or may seem mutually beneficial to them? can we co-opt them? Or do you think we need to over-regulate or regulate the shit out of them? What are your thoughts?
Time to go. Time to go. Well, there is no room whatsoever for fossil fuel industries. None whatsoever. We don't need it. We literally don't need it. We could be redirecting all of that energy, double pun in one podcast, into green energy development. There's absolutely no reason. We're looking at wars evolving right now. People, my family are in Sri Lanka. They're having a gas crisis right now. Like, we don't need to be in this position anymore. Like, this is the work that we're all trying to do.
Why do you think we are in this position? What's stopping us from completely just destroying this industry?
They're enormous and they're extremely powerful. But they are also flailing right now because they know they have felt the pressure that we have put on them. Hmm. We've done that work. And now the sort of current danger that's unfolding is greenwashing. Maybe you'd heard the term.
No, I would love to know what it means.
Yeah, I mean, we're in Pride Month right now. There's pride washing, right? You see, like, corporations who are absorbing, who are trying to co-opt justice movements to sell more stuff. The fossil fuel industry and peripheral industries are trying to do the same thing. They're trying to present themselves as like, oh, we're net zero this. And they're not. Yeah. And it's very hard for regular consumers to be able to see that that's what's going on. But that's why it's important for us to find the right outlets to get educated on this stuff.
You've probably had so many conversations around climate change, climate action. You've met so many folks. Was there a story or an example which really struck you, which really shocked you, made you rethink everything that you were doing?
I mean, I'm very privileged to be around some incredibly powerful women climate leaders around the world. And, you know, we get to hear the personal story that triggered their work. But, you know, the first person that comes to mind as you're speaking is a woman called Ursula Rakova, who is an indigenous woman from a matriarchal society in a Polynesian island called the Kartra Islands, which are just off the coast of Papua New Guinea. And the islands are about to disappear under the water forever. And that is the land where the bones of her ancestors are buried, right? And that's, again, it's not a... When we talk about and listen to, you know, these folks who are really existing through their culture in a very, very deep and meaningful way, something like that really, really matters. It really, really matters. That's the source of their spirituality, you know, as well as the source of their food and their homes and places that they're raising their children. But she is working to migrate her entire community to a larger, more secure island. So she's working to secure land plots for individual families and trying to get everybody over. But, you know, what is heartbreaking is that so many people are not willing to leave. Again, it's like the cultural perspective. They're not willing to leave and they're willing to just
stay there
and no matter what. And, you know, we brought Ursula's story onto the show as a climate solution, but really we still, I think, in the global north think that mitigation strategies are limitless. Mitigation meaning we can completely eliminate all of our climate problems and just get back to work. But there are so many people around the world who have zero mitigation options, and now it's about adaptation, and that is really, really, really hard to hear. That was really hard to hear. Listening to the story of Ariel Deranger in Alberta, in northern Canada, which is where the tar sands are. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of tar sands, but it's absolutely violent what happens to the land. It's people searching for oil who will dig. You know, instead of digging deep under the ground, they sort of, well, I think they do dig deep into the ground, but they allow the oil to seep up onto the surface of the land, which destroys absolutely everything, absolutely everything, and it will never come back. But her family are also indigenous, and she remembers, you know, camping on that land with her parents, and she does, you know, gives this beautiful description of birds and bees and butterflies and smells and just green everything, and then returning there 10 years later and driving up over a small hill and just the sounds of, you know, cranes and beeping of trucks and the smell and the death, you know, because from an indigenous perspective, the birds and the bees and the butterflies are her ancestors too, you know, that's her family, that's her perspective. And so it's, you know, it's sort of a, become a graveyard for her family members.
I remember just feeling like someone was sitting on my chest, like someone had just hit me in the chest, and I was overwhelmed by grief, like actual grief. And I couldn't breathe, and my ears started ringing, and I just sat there. I just started crying, like silently crying. And it was that moment that changed me for the rest of my life.
Yeah, there's a lot of really heartbreaking truth, you know, and it's not easy to think about, it's not easy to listen to, but these are the same people who are problem solving it powerfully. So why shouldn't we be listening to not just the people who are surviving it, but are actually like figuring out how to keep us all alive on this beautiful planet of ours?
I'm pivoting a little, but when you and I met the first time, it hasn't been that long, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I have to interview Thimali. And you said something like, you know, yeah, if I talk about climate change, I will talk about capitalism. How can we not talk about capitalism on this podcast? The irony of capitalism being the driver of climate change is that we all partake in it. Right? We are all active, passive participants. So step one would be acknowledging our role in capitalism, right?
Absolutely, yes.
But beyond that, how do we do less harm? Since it's, at least in my mind, it is almost impossible to completely escape the system. So how do we put our money where our mouths are?
Was that a pun, Sadia? That's good, because I can't do all the heavy lifting here. I mean, you might be talking to the wrong person, because I don't believe in capitalism at all. I don't believe it works. I don't believe that poverty should exist. I don't believe that there should be certain people at the top of the totem pole. I think it was... it has been designed and evolved to benefit a certain demographic of people. It doesn't work.
Right.
It literally does not work. And what the climate crisis is the byproduct of extractive capitalism.
Yeah.
In my opinion, that has also got to go. But you're right. I mean, we are so embedded in this system.
Right.
So what does that even look like?
Hmm.
I'm sitting in front of you in a neck brace because I managed to sprain my neck this morning. I wish it was because of fun, exciting things, but it was literally just probably binging John Oliver late last night, falling asleep in the wrong position. But I do not own a neck brace. I actually posted in my Buy Nothing group, which is a free economy within my neighborhood, just my neighborhood borders. Yeah, which is effectively like a mutual aid system for the neighborhood, which I found during the pandemic, actually. Where people just post things that they don't need anymore, or they post things that they actually are in search of.
Mm.
And so at like 7 o'clock this morning, when I couldn't move my neck, I posted a picture of that saying, "Hi, morning, everybody. Does anyone have a neck brace?" And a wonderful woman was like, "Don't worry, I'm coming to you. I'm coming to meet you. You're going to be able to get into the city to meet Sadia for the podcast. we'll get you there on time." And she arrived with this very neck brace. I met her on the street en route to you. So this is just like one example of a system change. You know, the mutual aid is one option.
Right.
Cooperatives is another beautiful option. That these are ancient practices, you know. Mm. But really, I think it is a consciousness thing. We have to really think, like, the places that we make money and the places that we spend money are the most political acts we make every day,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So can we have some consciousness around those actions? And yes, it's uncomfortable at first. You know, who wants to be guilt-tripping all day long? But when you realize there are plenty of alternate options for you, you know, I've only purchased, pretty much only purchased secondhand clothing since 1996.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Or like gifted clothes or exchange clothes with people. And I love it. It's so, where so much of my creativity comes from, actually. It feels like a very meditative act to do that. So, you know, zero waste is also something that was really challenging for me. But just sort of having consciousness about not accepting plastic bags and things like that. But where I'm shopping, like going to the farmer's market where there things aren't wrapped in plastic and things haven't had to travel from extremely long distances. And you're not going to be able to get absolutely everything
right.
in your world completely carbon neutral without systemic change. But we can shift our mentalities and grow our communities with those mentalities and create pretty strong paradigm shift.
And I think that also needs to happen within the context of individual versus collective. Because America, the way I see it, is a hyper-individualistic society that focuses on self more than anybody else. And coming from Pakistan, I find it so hard to get used to the idea.
Yeah.
And it's taken me so long and I still can't wrap my head around it. I don't know why. But that's something that also plays into this whole mentality of, you know, what I am doing versus what all of us are doing.
Absolutely. And that is, again, why the cultural piece is, again, why we should be listening to Black and Brown and Indigenous women and girls, right? You have some pretty powerful insights from Pakistan, probably,
right.
to share with Global North nations. We still live in this presumption that everything in proximity to white, affluent white societies is what's right, is what's best, is the optimal outcome.
Right.
And mothers of invention and within the communities that I function in, we are absolutely debunking that. Absolutely.
One story at a time, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, those are green, you know, you had access to incredible green spaces
right.
in Pakistan, right? We're kind of concreting over a lot of ours right now, but we're trying to flip that back. So where can we gain insights from? And people who are still successfully living within those environments are people we should be educated by right now.
And for that, it's important to look at BIPOC communities beyond their trauma and tragedy, rejection, right? Look at the other stuff, the insights they bring. You don't have to burden them with reliving their agony every time for your consumption, right?
Well said. And also, again, like, this is kind of why I pushed into the media, is because I got so sick. And I still feel like I've not been accurately represented in television ever, let alone my mom, let alone my grandmother,
absolutely,
let alone your grandmother, right? And because when cultures from other places in the world are represented on television or other mainstream media sources, it's always this sort of either tokenized or condescended, primitivized, you know, very anthropological. anthropological look at our cultures, as opposed to like the incredible wealth of knowledge
right.
from many, 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 many generations. And again, emphasis on Indigenous, because Indigenous people now only comprise 5% of the world's population because of colonization and slavery. Mm. But they protect 80% of the planet's biodiversity. 80%. Mm. They are literally keeping us all alive right now.
Right.
So to ignore that kind of knowledge and insight is an enormous mistake. And any Absolutely. Kind of solution that you develop without these kinds of insights are going to be half-baked solutions. And we're going to be back to square one in a year's time or 5 years' time or 10 years' time. And we're talking about the climate crisis. Mm. We don't have that kind of time available.
Which is happening right now. It's happening to BIPOC communities right now, in this moment, in real time. We talk a lot about 5 years, 10 years, but to be honest, it's happening. Some people may not feel the impact of it because they are probably privileged.
Yeah.
So
definitely the privilege is an enormous block in getting things done. Mm. I think there is this huge presumption that we are going to be all right. You know, in the global north, we don't have to experience pain if we don't want to.
Right.
You just pop a pill. You just, you know, pop to the doctors and everything's done. Like, we are at a time where we really sort of need to adapt around new knowledge. Like, this is it.
I love it, Molly. I think this was so good. With your accent, we were able to tackle so many difficult questions.
Even with my accent.
Even, like, with your accent. And we were able to trash capitalism.
Yes, anytime. And, you know, always talk to me if you want to trash capitalism.
But in the end, you're doing such an incredible, important work.
Thank you.
How do you take care of your peace and energy?
Oh, Sadia. Really terribly. Really terribly. You know, it is something that I thought, you know, we wrote our season 3 in 2020, and obviously a couple of things kicked off in 2020. Mm. We wrote our season around regenerative futures and self-care because we really saw the need to hold space for our audience through so many traumatic events. And, you know, I really thought that I got it and understood what self-care meant. But I think it is an eternal sort of work in progress and something right. that you really do have to keep coming back to. And, you know, like you, I come from a South Asian community, for me, immigrant community. So the idea of rest is like, what are you talking right. about? What are you complaining about? What are you talking? No, get up off your butt and go do some work, right. you know? So but that is, this is also falls off a capitalist mentality where you have to produce at all times and process is not valued. And, you know, stopping relaxation
it's not
is
valued.
Not, it's not valued. There's not even space for it.
Hmm.
Hmm. So I'm trying really hard to, yes, start with just slowing down and creating space for myself. But there are things that energize me that I'm not quite there yet. I'm an artist, I'm a painter as well, and I haven't made any work in so long. I was also a musician, haven't made music in a long time. These are things that really energize me and really do feel like I'm doing something for my spirit that is not just, you know, sitting in neutral, you know? And I think more of that, now I'm saying it to you, I feel like I'm having to hold myself accountable. So more of that definitely
is needed.
Is needed. But also a powerful thing that I do use frequently is amazing conversation with friends who help me unpack a lot of my mad thinking all the time. But then going out and dancing in the streets with them. I love dancing and I love music. And during the pandemic, we had all these amazing daytime block parties that showed up all over Brooklyn. And so usually the summer now is just back-to-back dancing. And that's, yeah.
I love it. And I think music and dancing are pretty cathartic.
Yeah.
I find it so cathartic, right?
You're a dancer too?
I try to, Thamali. I'm somebody who would probably just dance in my space, whatever that personal space is. I'm too shy to do it outside of that because I'm so bad at it. But I like it.
Yeah.
I like listening to music. But anyways, in the end, if you were to describe, and I can't wait for this answer, if you were to describe America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
What?
Yes!
I can't believe you're doing this to me. I mean, in a word, complex for sure. But I do see America doing it, you know, doing the work. I'm sort of surprising myself saying that out loud, but I think there's a lot of... There's a reason why all this crazy stuff is kicking off right now, and that, again, is because we are entering a paradigm shift, and people who don't like change are not happy about it, and people who do like change are finding friends, holding hands, and just going ahead and jumping. And, you know, I grew up in England, in London, which is a beautiful place to be as well, but I do see, you know, the problem with England is that people don't know that empire is a thing. They don't.
Right.
Did
you see all the celebrations?
I was like, oh my God.
I mean,
I'm throwing this in
at the podcast on that.
I'm throwing this in at the very end of your pod. I'm sorry, but you know, I spent like over 16 years in the education system in the UK, and you will not hear one word about the British Empire, about colonization spoken the entire time you're in the education
system. That's messed up.
It is so disturbing, right? It's creepy.
You know, I think, Thimali, Europe is a lot more racist than America. As residents of this country, as immigrants, we can say stuff. But to be honest, if I were to pick a place outside Pakistan, it would be the U.S.,
Interesting.
Always.
Yeah. Interesting. I think the thing about being in the US for me is that people know that slavery is a thing that happened. They might not agree with it and they're going to shout about it, but they still know it happened.
They know it happened, right?
It's not like they haven't actually been able to hide that from people.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I know. But nobody believes me when I say that here, but it's true. But what has happened in the UK is that it means that everyone, including people of colour, second generation immigrants, I'm talking about myself too, still, like, there's sort of this very, like, because it's not talked about, it's presumed it never happened. And so people are sort of just getting along with life. And the mainstream culture, which is still really English culture, English culture, with some fun colour in between, is kind of where everybody sits. But even folks of colour don't necessarily know their heritage. They don't know their British history. Like, I definitely did not know about these things until I moved to the States and got taken in by my black and brown friends who were like, oh, girl, we need to fix you, you know? But it is easier to move through the world in London, at least.
Because of lack of knowledge?
Because everyone's just getting along. Everyone's getting along. There's plenty of, you know, interracial relationships. And, you know, I don't get that kind of aggression or weird microaggressions or anything. That doesn't really exist in London, which is where I grew up. And I live in New York City now. But, In the States, it's everyone's wearing that stuff on their sleeves. That's hard. The difference is that in the US, in New York, it's actually being dealt with. It's actually being unpacked. And so, you know, when COVID happened, when BLM happened, like, I know from the outside, when you're looking from the outside into the US, it looks quite scary, but I felt like New York City was like the safest place in the world to be. Like, I was like, here, I feel like I can actually do something. And there are communities that are already deep into the work, as opposed to in London, where it's finally emerging. And a lot of that actually came off the back of the BLM movement in the US. So I do see, you know, the climate movement being an incredible opportunity to start addressing all of those issues.
I love it, Thimali. This was so good. Thank you once again for coming. I feel really bad.
But do not feel bad. It was a joy.
I'm so glad we had this conversation.
I'm so glad too. It's absolute joy to be here with you. This is a very special subject area for me, so I didn't want to miss it either.
Wow. What an incredible conversation. I urge all of you, our listeners, to think collectively, move beyond the individual, do some work when it comes to climate action, do work beyond recycling. There's a lot of work that we can do as individuals and collective. Today's episode was written by Yudi Liu, produced by me, Sadia Khan, and Kinza Muzahir. Our amazing editor is Bronte Cook. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter @immigrantly_pod, on Instagram @immigrantlypod, and do subscribe to our Patreon. That's how we sustain our podcast. That's how we grow and we bring these amazing, amazing stories to all of you. Until next time, take care. Oh.